That's a wonderful favorite of mine, Hank Crawford on alto sax and Jimmy McGriff on organ, with Jim Pittsburgh, on guitar and Bernard Purdy on drums. And that's Soul Survivors. The album was recorded in 1986. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and a program I hope you will find interesting and informative. And certainly today, for more than 200,000 Haitians living in the Dominican Republic, it's a day of reckoning. Our guest, Kim Ives, a veteran journalist, editor of Haiti Liberté, a newsweekly, a Haitian newsweekly. He's also a prize-winning documentarian, and he has been our guide on all things Haitian, and we are delighted to have him once again with us, because this isn't just a development, this is also a very important historical development, and we will learn why as Kim takes us through the history behind what is happening today. Thanks, Kim, for joining us.
My pleasure, Eutrice.
I'm so delighted that you could be with us today. It's a very daunting day in Haiti, as more than 200,000 Haitians, and perhaps as many as 500,000, have to decide, or it will be decided, whether they will be permitted to stay in the Dominican Republic. How did this come to be?
Well, as some of the listeners may know, Haiti and the Dominican Republic, which share the island of Hispaniola — well, Hispaniola is the name Columbus gave the island, the name the original Arawak Indians called it was Haiti, the entire island — the Dominican Republic and the country of Haiti share that island, and there has been great tension between the two of them, really going back to the Haitian Revolution in 1804. At that time, the Haitians liberated the entire island and abolished slavery on the entire island, the first and last time that a slave revolution was successful. However, under the reign of the Haitian generals that went forward after the 1804 revolution, some of the residents of the Dominican side of the island, who mostly spoke Spanish, incited to some extent by the colonial powers, which were doing their best to isolate and undermine the new fledgling free slave regime in Haiti. These people held a counter-revolution, if you will, and went back into colonial status with Spain, and later established the Dominican Republic. So ever since, the Dominican Republic has been some sort of, I could say, rear base for attacks against Haiti. And I could say that the entire culture in the Dominican Republic has become anti-Haitian, if you will. And I could even say anti-black, because many Dominicans have African ancestry, but they'll deny it. They'll say they are not darker because of African ancestry, but because of Indian ancestry, the Arawak Indians, which is, of course, absurd, because the Spaniards wiped out the 1 million Arawaks who lived on the island, mining in their gold mines, and that's why they had to begin importing slaves from Africa. So there has always been a really villainization of the Haitians who come to work in the Dominican Republic. And in fact, most of the Dominican proletariat is made up of Haitians. Every banister you see being polished in the Dominican resorts, in the every sugar cane stalk being cut, every cement sidewalk being laid, it's usually Haitian workers or Dominicans of Haitian descent. And this is the background, really, to this infamous law, which was passed back in September of 2013, called TC-16813. And what this said, what this law said, was that any child of a foreign migrant, who are 90% of them Haitian, is not Dominican, even if they're born on Dominican soil, but they are foreign and can be expelled. And that put tens of thousands, nobody really knows how many, but it's believed to be up to 200,000 Dominicans of Haitian descent, as well as the 524,000 about Haitian migrant workers in the Dominican Republic. And again, that's an estimate because nobody really knows, at risk of being deported. So to deal with the first group, the Dominicans of Haitian descent, this is a huge problem because many of them, in this law of 2013, again, TC-168/13, was retroactive all the way back to 1929. So that means you could have somebody who was 86 years old deported because they didn't have the right papers to show that they were Dominican. So this would make those people who would, those Dominicans who would be deported back to Haiti, a country they'd never visited, a language of Creole that they don't speak, essentially stateless because they would be neither Dominican nor Haitian. And so it's a huge problem in that respect. And in face of the tremendous outcry, a year later, the Dominicans made a procedure, again, where you could register to get Dominican citizenship if your name was listed in the civil registry of births. Well, this was very inadequate, to say the least, because a lot of people, they're living in the deep countryside, they're not going to register their birth. They have the child and they go forward. They, it never occurred to them that the usual process in most countries is if you're born in a country, like here in the United States, if you're born in the U.S., you are a U.S. citizen. But in the Dominican Republic, they've established this criteria on the basis of blood. That is, it's who's your parents. Not if you're born in Dominican Republic, it's who are your parents. If they're Haitian, you are deportable. If they're Haitian migrants. So this is the drama that we face. Tomorrow, deportations can begin for people who have either not registered as a migrant or who are not registered as a Dominican citizen. And you have only to travel along the border region, as I have, along the entire border, all the way from the northern city of Dajabon, all the way down to the southern city of near Ansapitre in the south. And you will see that there is really a blending of the two nations all along this border, with the population along the Dominican side is essentially Haitian and Dominican ancestry. All the people in all these towns, they have Haitian mothers and Dominican fathers, or Dominican mothers and Haitian fathers. And So it's this great melting pot along there, which is all now in peril of being picked up by the police because of the color of their skin, being too dark, and deported back to Haiti.
Now, this law, PC 16813, has drawn substantial criticism in the international community. International human rights agencies and organizations have pilloried this law as being, in effect, racist law, a law targeting Haitians. How has the Dominican Republic been able to resist the criticisms so successfully, to the point where literally today it has basically achieved its goal of reaching a very critical point in the dislocation and deportation, mass deportations of people the government, on a racist basis, has decided are really not desirable citizens or residents in the country?
Well, they've asserted their rights to sovereignty, which are indeed rights which are important in the Caribbean, given the bullying that the U.S. is always doing against Caribbean nations, or I could say any Western Hemisphere nation who doesn't bow to Washington's agenda. So they are saying, well, we are a sovereign nation and nobody can come putting their nose in our business. Okay, but one of the reasons why there's been a lot of, I could say, muted response is, in fact, if you just go a little north to the Bahamas, for instance, there is a very similar regime in place where they are beginning to deport Haitians. Of course, it's not the same numbers that there are in the Dominican Republic, but on the basis of their ancestry. And as the New York Times was pointing out just this week, yesterday, I believe, many countries are facing the problems of immigrants from other countries, many of them Haitian. You will find Haitians in countries around the Caribbean, from the Eastern Caribbean nations, especially Guadeloupe and Martinique, which are in fact colonies, but others as well, St. Croix, etc. You'll find many Haitians working in the hotels, in the construction sites, as child care workers, etc. And this is, to some extent, a problem that those countries feel they can't speak out too forcefully on because they themselves might want to expel people. So I could say that this is a dilemma of capitalism, if you will. I mean, capitalism wants freedom of movement for capital, freedom of movement for commodities produced by capitalism, but they don't want freedom of movement for the workers. They have to stay imprisoned wherever they originated. They don't have freedom of movement, what Marx called variable capital. They can't move. Just the other elements of the capitalist economy. So this is the great dilemma we face, and the perversions are this racist discriminatory law we see in the Dominican Republic.
Well, at the same time, this is a very real development. These things can begin happening. These deportations can begin happening as early as tomorrow. Mm-hmm. What within Haiti is the response? What is the response of the Michel Martelly government to the possibility of the forced migration, if you will, and the deportation of many Haitians back to Haiti? With Haiti itself struggling economically, what is the response in Haiti?
Well, it has been, I could say, quite muted. Most of the outcry against the law and against the Dominican Republic's policies has come from other nations of CARICOM. In particular, St. Vincent in the Grenadines has been very much in the forefront denouncing this. But Haiti has been much less vocal, much less outspoken. And just on June 6th, they had a meeting between the Haitian foreign minister, Lene Renault, and his Dominican counterpart, Andres Navarro, basically trying to put in place mechanisms to receive the expected flood of deportees that would be sent back. Now, Navarro, the Dominican foreign minister, has said, oh, no, there's not going to be any mass deportations. It's going to be on an individual basis. Each case is going to be taken into account. So he's very much been trying to downplay the humanitarian crisis which might unfold in the face of massive deportations, especially into Haiti, which, as we'll maybe go over, is extremely politically unstable right now, very fragile, in a complete economic meltdown. So this is just likely to pour poor gasoline on the fire that's going on in Haiti right now.
I want to ask a question that you may know the answer to or not, because it's legal. My question is based on the idea of this law, PC 168.13.
It's actually TC.
TC 168.13, going all the way back to 1930. Now, how does a country, under the claim of sovereignty, that it can make laws, of course, and it has a process for making laws, and apparently this law, TC 168.13, met all the criteria of a law duly passed within the borders of the Dominican Republic. But how do you justify, what is the legal claim that a country can target a particular individual by virtue of that person's ethnicity or race, if you will, going back to 1930, and on the basis of that, deport you to a country of which you never were a citizen?
Right. Well, their notion, the notion that was in fact passed by the Parliament in Dominican Republic, and this ruling of September 2013 was by the courts in Dominican Republic. Their notion is that what makes you Dominican is your parents. It's if you have a Dominican mother and a Dominican father, then you can be Dominican. But if you have foreign parents, and of course they put it in terms of foreign, but obviously they're speaking about Haitian. It's not specified Haitian, but most of the foreigners in the Dominican Republic are Haitian. Then you take the nationality of your parents. It's as if, you know, you were in the transit lounge of a of an airport when the child was had, and therefore you are. But you know, in many cases, these migrants, so-called, are have been living in the Dominican Republic, especially in the border regions, for decades. So when they have a kid, you know, the kid grows up speaking Spanish, running around with, you know, other Dominican kids, and, you know, they don't know that they're Haitian. They think they're Dominican. And so anyway, this is simply the way the Dominicans have found. But I just want to say here, Eutrice, that ironically, this law and this conception is so reactionary that even the multinationals who essentially own the Dominican Republic, because we have to remember that after the Cuban Revolution, a lot of the companies and businesses, everything from cigars to sugar, etc., all migrated over to Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico, most of it Dominican Republic. And these multinationals are very alarmed by this development because they, in fact, rely on the cheap labor brought to the Dominican Republic by the Haitians, because, again, the Haitians will work for wages that a lot of Dominicans won't. So this herein lies the problem. In a way, the Dominicans are feeling heat from not only neighbors, in particular, as I said, the Grenadines. St. Vincent and the Grenadines have been very vocal about this, but also from some of the multinationals who are saying, listen, guys, this is not going to help.
Is there any indication at all that the Dominican government is basically stepping back a little bit, saying, let's see if we can ameliorate the situation? It doesn't, but for one thing, it's a really very, very, very bad blot on the country. It is so screamingly racist, and the Dominican Republic doesn't need this kind of PR right now. So is there any indication at all that the government is kind of saying, let's kind of put a little bit more elastic here, let's reconsider, let's take a break and talk about this a bit more, or are they resolute and literally, as of tomorrow, these mass deportations are going to occur?
Well, two things. One, they did step back a little bit a year ago in May of 2014 when they passed a law or made a policy that they would open an avenue for children of Haitian parents to register for citizenship. That is, it wasn't automatic, but they would register, and if their name could be found in the civil registry, which, as I was saying, is not always easy in a very underdeveloped and rural country, where often such bureaucratic niceties are foregone, they could get citizenship that way. So that was one slight modifying step they took. The other one is that, of course, Andres Navarro, the foreign minister, is very much trying to downplay, saying, listen, we're not going to deport everybody en masse, as has been done in the past on several occasions. One that we might recall is in 1991 when President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was first elected to power, and the U.S. was starting to carry out its first coup against him. One of the things that happened was Juan Balaguer, or Joaquin Balaguer, the president at the time, perhaps in connivance with the U.S., made some mass deportations, which put huge pressure on the Aristide government because they had to put up camps and, you know, find places to put all these displaced people. So I think that, you know, Navarro is very much trying to say, no, it's not going to be like that. We're going to have a trickle of people individually, case by case, are going to maybe be sent back. So the Dominicans are trying to put as a happier face on this terrible situation as they can.
So what are you hearing, or what is being heard from a particular quarter, and I'm talking about the Clinton quarter, about mm-hmm. this dilemma? Since the Clintons have had such a great presence in Haiti, and they're so concerned, and the presumptive Democratic nominee for president in 2016 is so concerned about human rights issues.
Right. Well, I have not seen. I think they've been avoiding this particular issue like the plague. I haven't seen any statements about it from either Bill or Hillary Clinton. And in fact, I think Haiti is a tremendous Achilles heel for the Clintons, in particular Hillary, who had a major role in putting the current president, Michel Martelly, in power illegally after elections in 2010 and 2011, which the U.S. Completely meddled in. And Hillary was the principal actor in that meddling. So I think, plus the fact that, as we may have heard, brother of Hillary Clinton sits on the board of a gold company, which has been taken to task for trying to take Haiti's gold. Some $20 billion, as we've talked about, is believed to be in the mountains of Haiti. So in any case, we'll see if they make any statements, but I imagine they're going to try to avoid this issue as much as they can.
And at the United Nations, Kim, what is happening there with respect to this crisis that has now become quite possible to as of tomorrow?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because I even though I have not been at the United Nations of late to know what the discussions are, but the UN does have its a peacekeeping force in Haiti, the only country in the Western Hemisphere since the coup d'etat in 2004. They've been stationed there, and that makes 11 years now that they've been there. And the Haitians are completely fed up, want them out, and particularly are saying they need to be out for the elections to be held, because they meddled in the last elections. So could this all be part of, you know, could some U.S. Officials be rubbing their hands together saying, what a wonderful situation this is. We have this escalating crisis between between Dominican Republic and Haiti, and this will become a reason or an excuse to keep the MINUSTAH, as the UN force is called, in Haiti. So this is one sort of scenario which some people have speculated about.
And this now also is occurring against the backdrop of elections in Haiti. How does that come into the mix?
Well, the elections, which are scheduled for August, October, and December, are essentially to rebuild the entire government. It's going to be parliamentary. There's no parliament right now. The parliament expired because President Martelly never held elections in his 4 years in power, even though he was supposed to do it after the first 6 months. So there are legislative, municipal, and presidential elections all scheduled to take place on this staggered schedule of August, October, and December. And there are some groups, one in particular, the Dessalines Coordination, which are saying we can't have a free, fair, sovereign election with an occupation force there. They meddled in the last election. They'll meddle in this one. So they have to go before we can have any election. And also, the guy they put in, Michel Martelly, he has to go. We need a provisional government who can be independent. But there have been some developments in this past week, which I don't know if we need to break, but those developments have thrown a lot of this into confusion, and we can go into that.
Well, we will certainly have you come back and conduct one of your incredible courses for us, because you've been able to guide us through an understanding of what's going on in Haiti better than most people I know. So thanks for that. I'll take the rain check. But thank you today for helping us understand this developing crisis in Haiti. And I know you're going to be following it, so we may call on you again sooner than you know. Certainly as of tomorrow, we want to watch to see whether these hundreds of thousands of targeted people are in fact shuttled out of the country under these rather specious and contentious circumstances. But thanks so much today for being with us, Kim.
Well, thank you very much, Utrice. And again, I would say courage, as they say in
courage
in your program and in all the obstacles you face. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll take this break and come back and talk about an old American story posing as something brand new. Give the guitar a little respect here. Jim Pittsburgh on guitar in this wonderful, wonderful album, Soul Survivors, featuring Hank Crawford and Jimmy McGriff, with Bernard Purdy on drums. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead, and we're talking about an old story. It's an old story posing as something completely new, and that's because, hey, the media know exactly how to do this. This is the grist for the mill. Everybody knows that the issue of race just makes sparks fly in the United States. It's the mother load of stories. And there's reason, but they're not interested in telling you these stories because you should get and appreciate a deeper understanding of the role of race and race oppression in this country and the history and the consequences and impact. That is not the angle here. The angle is that it is salacious. And you know what I'm referring to. I'm referring to the story of Miss Dolezal, Rachel Dolezal. The saga continues to dominate the headlines with new stories. And, of course, the more stories that are being told, the more we can appreciate the deep family dysfunction that she came from. But, in fact, the story that started it all, this self-assigned racial identity as an African-American woman, is actually not a new story in America at all. It is an old, 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 old story. Now, why is it so compelling? Why is it compelling our attention? And nobody would say, of course, why. But they know. The reason is that it is an old story, but it has a little twist here. The person has defected to the, quote, losing side. We have a white woman eschewing the world of so-called privilege because it is widely assumed if you're white, that's what is accorded you. That's part of your entitlement. You automatically, by virtue of your white skin in this country, you have automatic access to the better things in life, to the privileges, to opportunities, and all of that. And why, with all of those advantages, would you defect? If you're going to defect, why to the other side? This is what is befuddling the media. Why would, and this is why it is a story, because she has, they're not saying it, she has chosen to defect to the other side. Now, I have an entirely different view. I think that there are some deep questions here about mental health. not because she decided that, taking on an African identity is a sign of mental defect, but it is about when you listen to the rationales and so forth, and you put this whole thing together, the story really is about a person in a kind of mental state where basically it's a struggle. She's been struggling for a long time. And ironically, she's struggling with the same thing that we all struggle with as black people in this country or people of color in this country. What is this obsession with our identity? And it is because it is linked to the social order, the political order, the economic order, and it has been designed as a system. The system has called the shots, and called the shots a long time ago. It predicted how we are supposed to behave, what we are supposed to think of ourselves, how we are supposed to conduct our day-to-day lives, what is to be our future. All these things had been taken care of in the design of the system, which was, of course, to operate in perpetuity on all of these planks that had been designed, so that a child being born in 2065 is already plugged in to this system, this apparatus that I said it follows a formula. That's why we need to understand racism as an applied science. There's a science to it. It's not just spontaneous. It's not one of those things that is, it just happens and it goes away. And no, these are permanent pillars in our society. So this Miss Rachel Dolezal has kind of reversed it, and it kind of embarrassed whiteness in this country. Now, I'm not suggesting that it's immaterial whether I approve or don't approve or like it or don't like it. We're looking at it from a clinical perspective. This is what has happened. What do we make of it? And what we certainly can make of it is that in this story, she has kind of really offended white America. How dare you jettison us, meaning how dare you defect from the ruling class, your membership, even though tenuous, but you're one of us. You're not supposed to defect to them. You're not supposed to even want to do that. And this makes you really, really ill. And in a way, this accounts for not just the fascination, the perverse fascination, but also there is a level of animus in the coverage. She is a defect. Now, here's what's interesting. When whites defect to belong to the ruling class, there has never been a problem too much. I mean, there's been an accommodation. Because don't forget, whiteness was very strictly defined in this country. Not everybody who had white skin was white. Whiteness was, conferred in a political sense. You didn't just, become white. If you doubt it, you need to read your history. It's fairly recent. Eastern Europeans who came to this country had to essentially wait it out to find out if they could be white. And many of them who wanted to be white without being granted permission to be white themselves took on a white identity. In the understanding, in his political understanding, they took on a white identity. Italians in this country were not white. The Irish were not white. In fact, there's a book I recommend to you, Noel Ignatieff's book, How the Irish Became White. whiteness as a power construct was not for every white person in this country. Jews coming from Eastern Europe became Smith and anglicized themselves in order to be white. That wasn't seen as a major perversion, was it? That didn't cause the presses to run and intense media coverage. All the so-called ethnic groups from Europe who were not white in this country, they just recently and on, I know, pretty serious conditions, they were tentatively admitted to the ranks of whiteness in this country. That hasn't caused a major concern, has it? So it's very fascinating to me that people think of this as a new story. People by the millions have been bending their identities and doing so in order to qualify for membership among whites, the people who are defined as whites in this country. Why? Because that's where they perceive the power rested. Social power, political power, economic power. They were the dominant group. They still are the dominant group in these categories. And why wouldn't, if you have the ability to, you know, gain membership by whatever means, among the power elite, that's what you do. Because in the end, it's about survival. It's survival. And if the system that you are part of places top priority on skin color as a necessary requirement for membership in the ruling and dominant and supreme class, if you have it physically, well, you could try and see if you can have it on the other counts as well. Economically, politically, socially. There are a lot of people running around with anglicized names who don't want anybody to know they're Jewish. Or Romanian. Or Lithuanian. And that's been going on for centuries. Whites have been defecting for centuries. Whites have been changing and altering their ethnicities for a long, long time. But it is because the intent is to seek membership. That is to say, they value whiteness in the way that the system insists that whiteness be valued. Because they're congruent with that, it's all right. Here's a person who said, I'm opting out. Not only am I opting out of whiteness, I'm switching sides completely. And they don't know how to handle that. Now, I have my own issues with this, but it's not up to me what she has decided. Because there's an interesting thing. Because of whiteness, you can also change your mind. She still has the option. Even after defection to the other side, she still has the option to say, oops, that was a mistake. I'm back to being blonde and blue-eyed. Yeah, you may have to go through a little test to find out if you still qualify. But the point is, she has options. Again, because of her skin color in this country. That's the whole fascination here. But of course, it would never be said. The millions and millions and millions of now people we now call white who took on that identity and just removed their so-called congenital identity, the one that we're born with. They gave that up in a hurry. The trade-off was intoxicating. If I could cease to be ethnically whatever and become white in America, I'll be all right. I would have added, because of that trade-off, I would have added a number of benefits to myself and to my family, my children. I could get a job in an industry. Look, it wasn't too long ago, for example, the Jews were not allowed, really, on Wall Street. They just were not allowed there. Racist, but that was the fact. But then many anglicized themselves to show deference and to show obedience to the construct of whiteness. You know, they were ostracized even in New York City. They weren't even allowed to go to colleges. So these groups, European groups, mostly ethnic groups, coming into this country were not automatically white, absolutely not. In fact, you have records that show the Irish and African slaves lived side by side, even intermarried. You had all these anomalies occurring. And then it became clear to them at some point, a magic pill that could fix my situation and position me to be prosperous in this country, to get along, to achieve all the things that I want to achieve, a magic pill could be my white skin. Because that was what the all-encompassing power projected. And it is true. And so we have decided, the media had decided, this is not a story. The millions of defections that occur every single day, and all these times that this country has existed as the United States of America, this has been happening. So this is not a new story. What's new? She defected. She gave up. She insulted whiteness. Come on now. She has to pay a price. She insulted the concept of whiteness. And worse, she went to the other side. She went to the other side. She went to the losers for redemption. She sought redemption among the losers. She allied herself in all these different ways with the people who are just not desirable. So that was a double whammy. She's got to pay. So you see, it's an old story. Don't get all alarmed about it. But ask yourself the question, how is it possible, or why is it the case, that this one person's defection to blackness completely outweighs the millions and millions and millions of defections of whites to whiteness? Isn't that a great story? How whites are defecting in the millions to whiteness in America. Because supremacy is what they seek. And that's what whiteness, in the political sense that I'm talking about, that's the number one prize. That is the desired item. That is the ring. So don't get flustered when these stories come hit you in the face and you think, oh, it must be really important. No, take a little bit of time and you'll see. Put it in perspective and you go, ah, you tried a good one, but it ain't working. I have read you. You're not prepared to educate me. I know this country. I know what the story really is. Well, that brings us to the end of the program today. I hope it did something for you. I hope it was interesting and informative. And I want to thank you for joining me here every day on PRN.FM. We're getting closer to the point of being able to talk with each other. I look forward to that so much as the studios are going through their very final stages in getting prepared to move ahead. Stay right here. Coming up next is the NDC Savings Club. You can write me at leadstories@gmail.com. Send me a note. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. I do love hearing from you, and I really am catching up with my correspondents. I really am. Thank you. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your esteemed company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.